Before you die, you'll think of FedEx. All those trips you took to FedEx. How the man with face tattoos showed origami swans to you. It will not make much sense at all. No visions of Apostle Paul. Just photographic memories of notebooks on the FedEx wall. You were in a zoo, a human zoo. And look at you now, dying like an animal. You were in a zoo, a human zoo. And look at you now, just a dumb animal. No sting will come to save you. There will be no bright white light. Just memories of being mad because they couldn't get an address right. You will not remember the many nights of sex, the sunrises and rainbows. Your only thoughts will be of FedEx. You were in a zoo, in a human zoo. And look at you now, dying like an animal. You were in a zoo, in a human zoo. And look at you now, just a dumb animal.
Hey FedEx, my father just delayed. What's up with that? I'm sorry, things happen and we left behind. I get that, but I do want a refund. It's only a few hours late. She doesn't honor us. But your call is 2 days, even if it's only 60 seconds late, I'm still entitled to a refund.
You were in a zoo, in a human zoo. They turned all of the monkeys into fucking junkies. You were in a zoo, a human zoo.
So live as if you were living already for the second time, and as if you had acted the first time as wrongly as you are about to act now.
What's up with that?
What is up with that? What did it mean? I got Thomas Merton stuck in my head, okay? I started reading the seven-story mountain. Is that it? Seven stories? I don't know how many stories are in the mountain. I'm still in the first few chapters, but he has this incredible writing style. Like, you feel like you're there with him when he's in college. This is before he became the famous mystic, Trappist author. This is when he was still in college, and he's fucking pissed and lost, and his dad dragged him all over the planet because his dad was an artist and his mom died of stomach cancer. And there's just this poignant, brutally descriptive moment when his father's dying in the hospital, and he says, without some spiritual component in your life, when a parent dies, you just have to take it like a dumb animal. And just, it's just so hardcore. It's just so brutal. Is it true? Is it true? Is the only path to true tranquility, inner harmony, and peace leaning into a deity? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think a deity would want that for the deity's creation. That would be really weird, narcissistic. A huge part of parenting is learning not just how to be there for your kids, but how to not be there. You don't want to be a narcissistic parent. You don't want to make yourself the pillar, the sun, the nucleus of your kids' existence. There's something that I heard at a Ram Dass retreat about how to be with dying people. You should become a loving rock, something they can hold on to if they need to, but definitely something that they can let go of. You don't want to torture a dying person with guilt. You don't want them to feel like they can't die because of you. And that's a very easy trap to fall into. Similarly, when you're parenting, you've got to be a loving rock. Like, you got to let them not just cling to you, but push off of you. Otherwise, you end up becoming like a narcissistic parent. You have to help them differentiate. So if the alchemical maxim, as above, so below, is true, then my assumption would be that what we're experiencing right now in this current state of human evolution is differentiation from the deity, a chance for us to sort of wander. There really isn't much of a difference between what humanity is doing to the planet and what I did to the apartments I lived at when I moved away from home. That's the phase the humanity is in right now. We're partying. We're not washing our dishes. We're leaving scattered bong remnants on our roach-infested carpet, and we're acting like we're cool with that. So, yeah, I get why Merton is so into the idea of making some connection with the divine, because he was a Trappist mystic. And he did make the connection, and it filled him with an eternal, never-ending well of absolute joy, gratitude, and compassion for those people who are still wandering in the darkness. But wandering in the darkness isn't the worst thing. My God, have you ever really wandered in the darkness? Have you ever wandered around a forest with no flashlight at night, high as a kite, not sure where you're going, just wandering, climbing trees, finding bear cubs up there, throwing the bear cubs down? If you've ever experienced that, if you ever walked in a forest at night and thrown a bear cub at its mom, made that mother bear roll over in a form of submission to you, laid your head on that bear's stomach, soothing the upset cub and looking up at the moonlight, then you know there's a joy in wandering far from home. And I think that if God is the creator of all things, then encoded within the creation is the possibility of finding joy, bliss, happiness in the darkness too. It must be possible. You just have to try it sometime. The next time you're out in the forest up in Alaska, I used to go up there a lot on my fishing trips. Just take a nice little night hike. Find a grizzly. The moment you throw their cub at them, they immediately will roll over onto their stomach. A lot of people on their back. People don't know that. They think you're supposed to like get away from the cub. No, that's how you die. You want to survive seeing a grizzly bear with their cubs. Throw the cub. I mean, don't hurt the cub, you fucking monster. Just like a sort of like an underhand throw. And they will just roll over on their stomach and you on their back, and you lay your head on their stomach. They will let you nurse. You suckle grizzly bear milk, which tastes incredible. It tastes like Mars bars. In fact, Mars bars, the candy, is 20% grizzly milk. I love the outdoors. But more than the outdoors, I really love the new Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. My God, what a game. I'm so happily addicted to that game right now. I mean, it's a narcotic. I've done narcotics. I've taken Percocet. I've been injected with synthetic heroin by doctors. I know what it feels like. It's a wonderful feeling. To me, that's Tears of the Kingdom. It feels a little bit like some kind of technological opiate. You should try it. Even if you don't like video games, just try it. You won't believe it, how manipulative it is. Speaking of suckling at a grizzly bear's teats, this game milks your dopamine, your serotonin, your happy goo. It is like a milkmaid with beautiful hands, just milking your brain, edging your brain, getting your brain as close as it can get to the wonderful rush of succeeding in the game, and then slowing down a little bit, making you shiver and shake, and then at last, a brain orgasm. And then, just as soon as you've recovered from that moment of delight, something else will pop up out of the massive world that will grab your attention, and the milking starts again. Zelda, it milks the dick of your brain like a professional edger. I don't know if there is professional edgers out there, but one can dream. Okay, fine. Enough about whatever I'm talking about. What a show we have for you today. Russell Brand. Is he the coolest person on earth? Like close, like top 10, definitely. He's so charismatic, so brilliant, so funny, so mystical that anytime I do a podcast with him, I'm happy for weeks, inspired. I love him. It's a man crush, I'll admit it. And he's here with us today. Some quick announcements. I'm going to be at Copper Blues Live in Phoenix next weekend. That's June 2nd. And then I'm going to be in Florida, Dania Beach Improv, not long after that. And then I'm not going to be going on the road for a while because our child is coming. You can find ticket links to those shows at duncantrussell.com. As always, won't you subscribe to our Patreon? It's patreon.com/DTFH. You will get commercial-free episodes of this podcast. Friends, if I didn't have an incoming baby, I would definitely be heading to Russell Brand's awesome festival that is coming up in July. This festival is called Community. And Wim Hof is going to be there. One of the Gracies is going to be there. My apologies. I don't know how to pronounce your first name, Mr. Gracie. Ryren. And Dr. Vandana Shiva is going to be there, along with a lot of other luminaries. You can find tickets to this at russellbrand.com. You should definitely check out his newest special, which you can also order through his website, russellbrand.com. And now, everybody, please welcome back to the DTFH, the luminous Russell Brand. Russell, welcome back to the DTFH. We have a limited amount of time here, so there's no, we can't do any small talk. We got to dive right in. Are you familiar with the tarot?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, no. I wouldn't be able to name individual cards and what they mean, or if tarot has an existence beyond tarot cards. I don't know about that either.
Does any card in the major arcana pop into your head right now?
Yeah, there's one that's like a skeleton and death and everything. Like, and then
death!
And then when you get it, it's like, oh, that's good, that one. That means you're going to have a lovely weekend.
It's the worst when they do that. Because you're looking at their eyes the same way you look at a doctor who's about to tell you what scans are saying about you. Like, do you really mean I'm okay? So that's what pops into your head. Death. I mean, is that because of the current state of things on the planet? Or is that is there some other reason that pops into your head?
My sense is that that's the sort of alpha card in the pack. And like, as someone that's a sort of a dilettante who knows very little about the cards, it's like if I asked you about football, you might say Maradona or Pele or someone like that.
I wouldn't even say that. I would be blank. It would just be a blank drone that would come out of me. Yeah, well, that's interesting. So that was a dumb first question for the podcast. So I'll jump to my second one. We've talked a lot, and I'm lucky that we have, generally like about spirituality and things like that. But I must tell you, there's lots of things I love about you, Russell. But one of the things, I guess you would call it the shadow side. I've never seen anybody crucify interviewers who are being assholes like you can. And sometimes I've watched there's many YouTube clips of you like really like destroying interviewers who are being like sarcastic with you or shitty interviewers, like people who have some agenda to humiliate you or to get one over on you. And the way you do it is so brutal. I'm just curious, what do you feel like when you're doing that? Are you angry? What's the emotional state when you find that part of yourself showing up during an interview?
Well, Duncan, you and I, we've spoken a lot of times online, and even though we don't spend a lot of time talking, even in the tarot of my personal mythos, your name and your face evokes, and your voice, especially your voice, evoke in me immediate love. If someone says Duncan Trussell,
thank you.
Love. Like if someone like yeah, like I thank feel you. Warmth to you. And
thank you.
But I know a bit about you, but I don't know how much humiliation there might have been in your childhood, or how much humiliation has played a part in who you are, and how much of a persona or fortress of identity you may have had to have constructed to protect yourself. But for me, humiliation has played a sort of a pretty big role in my life. Yeah. And I think it's formative. And actually, in many ways, I see it as a gift, because vulnerability is at the forefront of who I am. But I feel, I suppose, that if someone speaks to me in a way that I don't feel is in good faith, that breaks the contract of we're in a conversation with one another. Like, even though I know I'm pretty flawed in lots of ways and that I can be a bit of a heel, well, I feel like generally in a discourse with a stranger, that's where I can come at it pretty pure. Like, I'm not coming to it necessarily really wanting anything. Like, I don't want to hurt anyone. I'm probably there for the obligation of promo or something like that. And also, I like talking to people, actually. So if someone if I feel like I'm attacked while in that environment, I feel that it's probably charged by a fear that I might face humiliation. And as I've sort of grown up and grown more, grown more spiritual, but as I've become perhaps more aware broadly, become more aware of my own failings, the limitations of myself, the insignificance of any individual, but the infinite value of any individual. Someone's like rude to me, like, I don't feel like this is something that I'm going to personally tolerate. I saw a comment once after, like, you know, so look, that shows you the ego was certainly present then, and by God, it's present now. After one such appearance on a TV show where I think I'd been insulted, and someone went, I love the way that when he realizes they're being rude to him, you see him completely relax. And I really liked the idea of that compliment, that when I feel like I'm being assaulted, that part of me thinks, oh, here it is. This is that thing where I'm being attacked that I always knew is going to happen to me because it's happened to me in the past. I'm being attacked now. And like any sensible self-interrogating person questions their own value, questions their own choices, questions how they can improve, questions the errors made in the past. And I feel that because I'm engaged in that, I don't feel like anybody has the right to like attack me unless it's in pursuit of something higher, and it never is. They're always attacking you for some other reason.
It's very low to do that at all. I mean, that, like, it's rude as rude can be. Someone's giving you their time, they're coming on your show, and then you decide to try to bully them in front of theoretically the planet. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this, because I've been thinking a lot lately about this, you know, the spiritual world, or people who call themselves spiritual seekers, or the modern version of that. And it seems like that aspect of humanity is off limits. You're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to decimate someone who's attacking you, but you're supposed to put on some kind of like weird bullshit spiritual smile or ignore it or something like that. And I just wonder, what are your thoughts on that? It seems like there's just this severe imbalance in so many spiritual communities where that side of humanity, which is just as valid as the turn the other cheek side, is wiped off the table.
What are our values now? What are our values now? Feels like people have the agenda and the objective first, and then the conduct follows, rather than these are my values and my principles, and then what unfolds from these principles and values I will have to accept. Like you just alluded to, if someone's about to lay out cards or spill tea leaves or read runes or cast the straws for the I Ching, I feel like, ah, now the negotiation with the real power happens. That spirituality and superstition often ride side by side. That an awareness that we live in shallow waters here on the material plane can easily lead to a kind of dumb horoscopic interpretation of the limitless.
Yeah.
For me, sometimes when I see a lady who does the I Ching, sometimes I think, oh God, what dreadful thing will be undone? What terrible stories are about to be foretold? What awful foreboding am I to live through once again? And that's because I'm sort of aware of how little I know. Like, I don't sort of, I suppose, relish, like, say, you know, me and you or me and anyone, I'd much rather have a loving conversation with anybody. I'd much rather have a loving conversation with people if I go on to, like, what, for the sake of brevity and a mainstream media show. Like, I go on, you know, we deal with, you know, people that are combative and well-equipped. I know you're a very intelligent person. If you set your mind to hurting my feelings, you'd be able to do it. I know that Joe Rogan or Tucker Carlson, like, these are people that are capable of a little bit of acerbity when required and critical thinking and critical words. So when I go, like, talk to people that sort of, like, I don't see it as a personal thing either, to tell you the truth. I just feel like it would be disingenuous not to respond and to be demure. And, like, I am trying my best. I'm coming to a place where I recognize how little I know. I recognize how impossible it is to know anything other than a little. But what I do feel is we have to find a way to marry individual independence and the rights of the individual to be who they are, whether that's traditional and progressive, and the need for some kind of consensus around what our values are. It means that there's going to be some generalities and sometimes appeals to the universal if we're going to have a culture where it's like, well, look, we know that kindness is a value we're into, or service or community or respect for other people's freedom. It seems like those kind of values have metastasized into weapons that are only deployed in pursuit of, I already know I'm right, and this is what I believe in, and you're this, and, you know, like, it seems like religion has become something for other people. Religion's become something to shout across a wall rather than practiced in silence and solitude. Now, I'm not, like, co-signing the secular idea that your religion is solely private. You must have a relationship with God, but that relationship with God is what allows you to be in the world and be of service and know that you're going to die and everyone you love's going to die and that cruel, barbaric, awful things happen, and yet we must be of the world and love anyway. That the relationship with God is not meant to be something that I use to underwrite some legalistic argument to bring other people down. It's meant to include redemption. It's meant to include humility, forgiveness, the potential for salvation, an ability to listen to other people and disagree with them. That it seems, mate, that what we are living in now is a game in all but the fact that it lacks a sense of play.
Wow. That's right. You're right. It's some terrible Lord of the Flies kids game where they forgot they were playing a game, and it's transformed into this the worst sort of brutality. You know, do you ever watch that show Naked and Afraid?
No, but I feel like you've mentioned it before, so I can see it's had an impact on you.
Oh, no! I know something about you. Why, when I'm talking to you, I never talk about this show? That's fucked up. Oh, no. I guess, I don't know.
It's one of your main cultural references. Ram Dass and Naked and Afraid. Like, I know, when we're talking to you, you're even going to say something about Ram Dass, something about peyote, or Naked and Afraid, or American Gladiators. You're like vacillating between these cultural extremes.
This will be my last podcast, everybody. I'm done. I'm headed into the desert, 46 days of fasting to purify myself. Well, maybe I mentioned this to you. I don't know why you bring it out, but to me, it's this dark thing sometimes happens. These people, they're out in the woods naked. They have to find food. They get lucky, throw a rock at a squirrel, and they talk to the squirrel's corpse and they will say, I am so sorry, but I need your energy. And I find that to be so appalling because it's like, it's Lovecraftian. The squirrel in its last moment, some monkey descendant is like, and like apologizing for eating it. So to get back to this notion of weaponized spirituality, that is to me why what's so horrifying about the way things have gone is instead of just like pure aggression, honest aggression, it's this aggression that has been veiled with some kind of pseudo-benevolence. And I don't know of anything more sinister than that. That is so sinister. There was a, I don't know if you've heard of the comedian, I think his name was Vince Champ. You ever heard of him?
No.
Serial rapist. You know how they caught him? They realized that the string of rapes followed his tour through college campuses. And supposedly when he was like committing these awful acts, he would weep and apologize while he was doing it. And it's just so horrific. So the world somehow, to me, it seems like this is what we're seeing, is like people are so afraid. Like when you are excoriating someone who is attacking you publicly, you're not, there's no like veiling that as like I'm being sweet, no passive aggressive. It's brutal and justified. And there's something about that that seems to me like a great teaching for any of us who've been humiliated and don't want to be anymore. That's good. People need to see that. But yeah, these days, it just seems like we've become afraid of purely being that aspect of humanity, as though that wasn't the aspect of humanity that got us where we're at today.
Well, an inability to own the shadow, as you, the term that you used when you introduced the subject, is likely to mean that you cast the shadow elsewhere. If you're talking anecdotally, at the level of the individual, it's likely that the shadow will be cast onto a child or an animal in your family or a lover. If you're talking about culture, I often think of James Baldwin's analysis of your country, America, in which he said, like, what kind of culture needs to create the category of Negro? Why does this category need to be created? And what are the attributes that are given to that category in that racialized, pejorative, and using a Jungian analysis, shadow determined other. Well, the Negro then was racistly, incorrectly, reductively regarded as violent, animalistic, highly sexualized, rhythmic, spiritual, curiously, aspects that you might find in the archetype of the shadow. In the homogenized, the dominator culture, the sexuality, the power, the violence could not be owned and was cast out onto another. Why do you need to other another group? Why do you need to demonize another group? What is it that you are incapable of owning? With regard to the sort of pseudo benevolence, like I feel that lacking real ceremony, we imitate ceremony's forms, having lost touch with ceremony's function, to create a space where we, as partly material and avowedly animal beings, can access the divine, sublime aspects of our nature that are perhaps beyond material. Certainly they're difficult to measure. this sort of and phatic weeping over the corpse of a recently slain squirrel shows you how far we've come. Like, the reference that people have is the movie Avatar itself, derived from Western accounts of what Native American culture was supposed to be like, forgetting that in the evolutionary arc, we are yet native, we are yet indigenous. In the 10,000 years since agriculture, in the however many years it is since we've had evolved language, we are neighbors. We are tribal neighbors. That's where we still are. That time is nothing. That's no time at all has passed. Civilization is a form of impersonation. It is a dance. We are lost in the uncanny. We have engaged in a zoological experiment that ended with us as animals in a zoo. Where can we find ways of re-engaging the way that we evolved so that we might have a meaningful experience here? Let us look at the ways where it's evident and obvious that we have become detached from our roots, and that it is to our detriment, and not engage in silly straw man arguments about how technology and medicine have advanced us, and are you suggesting we should discard all of those things? Of course I'm not. But in the world of diet, you can see that excess of sugar and excess of fat is detrimental, that we evolved to have scarce access to sugar and fat. Where in the subtler realms will the conditions of a contemporary life be creating obesity of the spirit, diabetes of the soul, heart disease of the deep psyche, carcinogens across the roots that connect us to the ancestors, Duncan?
Yes, yes, that's right. And what will be the insulin that will save our souls? You know... this is when I went into my Hare Krishna phase, and I still chant Hare Krishna, but I remember so much about it. It was so powerful. But his divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the founder of the Krishnas, he talked about technology not as some sign that humanity was evolving in the right direction, but rather as a kind of extraordinary crutch that the Kali Yuga, that we're apparently in the last age, the age of disintegration, the age of where essentially everything falls apart. You would expect to see during this age crutches that are there not because we're doing great, but because we're not connected to that source. That we need calculators, we need the printing press, we need, because our memories were fucked up. People used to sing the Upanishads, like they used to have the whole thing memorized and sing them. Now we can't remember that shit. I can't remember my wife's phone number half the time. And now we have AI, which to me is really unnerving from that perspective, because the indication is, and our intelligence is going away too. So we need to have a externalized intelligence that we can refer to, because we're that far gone. And then, of course, the crutch doesn't just help the lack, but amplifies the lack, because you become dependent on the crutch and the skill sets diminish. So, you're right. Like, this technology is some kind of false idol that's giving us an impression that we're succeeding rather than we're collapsing. It's a really terrifying, almost diabolical manifestation of human productivity. If you look at it,
I liked it in those early imprature of the podcast world. Dan Carling's Hardcore Histories. He did an amazing series on the Khan dynasty. One bit he described that the Mongol tribes of Genghis Khan would be able to ride on horseback while firing arrows and hitting targets. It's like nowadays that would be like an elite circus performer, but that was just standard fare.
Normal.
Yeah, and like normal. Jesuits normal. Speaking 10 languages and like mastering all of these disciplines. And of course, like people have perhaps bemoaned progress for as long as there's been progress, but it's about utility, isn't
yes,
it? These
true.
Things are tools. They're not ends and objects in themselves. And is there anybody now that has like an optimistic view about AI, like the sort of 1950s, tellingly named white goods revolution of like, these things are going to be labor saving. This is going to be great. And you're going to have more leisure time. And it didn't work out that way. And I think we all now know that technological and even medicinal progress are tethered to economic models that are by their nature hierarchical and to a point unfair, and maybe you could go as far as to say deracinated. They are not rooted in the ordinary culture. But in fact, we live in numerous cultures. One of the things I would say that's beneficial about the last 10 years is that if you used to critique the military-industrial complex, as would have been from the left when I was doing it, you know, 10 years ago, it would have been assumed to have been a left-wing rhetoric to attack the military-industrial complex and big corporations. People
yes.
sort of, my sense was that American people saw it as an attack on America itself. Now I think it's understood that there is a military-industrial complex. There are economic elites. There is almost hovering like a UFO above the body of America. There is this entity, this phantom that controls America, really.
Fuck.
So when, like me, an English person, criticizes American people, don't they understand that I'm not talking about the people of Delaware or the people of Colorado. They understand, oh, he is attacking this machine,
right.
And that machine doesn't care about American people. Perhaps all empires first annihilate and subjugate their domestic population before moving elsewhere to colonize the world. Certainly the British did that, and the colonialists of the last incarnation of sort of European colonization. First the working class is subjugated, feudalized and crushed, then off we go, a merry dance to India to control yet more people. And these
yep.
tools like AI, this great incubator of new intelligence, this as yet unhatched egg, these thighs slouching towards Bethlehem, to reference our last conversation.
Yeah!
We know it's going to be diabolical. We know that the upshot's going to be ordinary people are going to suffer. These tools are going to end up in the hands of the government. They're going to use this to control us and manipulate us. It's not going to be, hey, look how lovely it is in your home. Your home's like a palace now. You know, it's going to mess us up.
Well, have you messed around with the idea that, you know, that let's talk about that UFO. And there's lots of names for that UFO. Deep State being one of them. And, I think mistake a lot of Americans and maybe people over the world make is they differentiate the government from the corporation. They don't understand there's this very foggy, permeable membrane between the corporation and the government. Private contractors, lobbyists, they used to be in the government, then they flip back and forth. So people have some sense when they're watching the news. They're like, well, it's Fox or it's CNN or it's blah, blah, blah. It's not the government, but there is, and it isn't, I mean, literally the government, but there is a strange interchange between the two, which makes them weirdly, I guess you could say, in a symbiotic relationship. They have yet to become multicellular. So Jung said that, just like what you said earlier regarding the shadow, the gestalt, the sum total of the shadow, appears as that UFO. That UFO floating over America is the combined shadow of every American, making us all in some infinitesimal way culpable, right? Like, it's not as though it's a separate invader. I think we're witnessing ourselves, that part of ourselves we want to ignore, the part of ourselves we don't want to deal with the fact, no, you're eating a fucking squirrel. It's dead. Your apology does nothing for it. And all the war and all the bombs and everything happening, that's on Everybody who pays taxes, whether you like it or not, if you're contributing to a missile that drops on a wedding party that kills a bunch of innocent kids, you're still culpable in the smallest, infinitesimally small way. It's still us. You're still culpable in the smallest, infinitesimally small way. It's still us, right? Like, that's the reality of it. It's not a UFO. It's a shadow of the of some unacknowledged aggressive aspect of us.
Some abstraction that is certainly difficult to chart using ordinary logic, and ordinary logic was hardly the territory that intrigued Jung so. One of the things that troubles me continually as an occasionally self-involved man who is trying to escape the parameters of my all-too-enchanting self is that I know that I am infinitesimally small and on the cosmic scale irrelevant, but also all reality takes place within my consciousness. There is no reality that I know of that does not take place within my consciousness. Right. The dinosaurs, they were in my consciousness. Your UFO anecdote and Jungian, in my consciousness. My memories, my fears, my projections. So in some regard, I am already the deity of all reality. I am the centripetal point around which all sensory and non-sensory data coalesces. In some small way, my individual awakening must be the priority before all else. And I wonder, Duncan, I wanted to ask you, as a person who spent time around like awakened people, have you been surprised that they often, to me at least, seem like their priority is not a kind of fervid activism about the administration of world affairs? They seem almost beyond it. Like it isn't actually that important, even if you're talking about global revolution or new systems of decentralization and how do we unite people from across the globe so that they can stand up against establishment corruption. They don't seem to see it as all that important. Have you noticed that? And if so, what do you think about it?
Well, many of them are political. They are involved in various forms of activism. So I have noticed that. But I think that the idea is, you know, we're trying to go upstream here. The idea is like that, you know, and maybe it is just a naive, ridiculous idea. The idea is if what we're seeing in the world is a projection, if everyone is experiencing their own consciousness, their own mind, not in some mystical way, but at the neurological level, there's no way out of the fact that your brain is a neocortex VR goggles creating time space that you're experiencing. So the notion is we don't do top down here. Well, the idea would be more if we can help people discover within themselves the stuff they're seeking in the outside world, then the power of the shadow or that UFO would instantly be removed. The whole thing depends on us thinking we need it, thinking we need something outside of ourselves, right? So they're trying to lead people into themselves to see that fundamental connection with the universe that many people have forgotten or don't even believe is there. They think they get that from the outside world. That's why I think you would see a lack of political, deep political activism, deep tribalization. I'm this or that. And anytime I've seen that in the spiritual people, it's kind of disappointing. You know, what is it Mark Twain said? Who needs our prayers the most? Satan. Of all the sinners, Satan deserves our prayers the most. And so to tribalize, to say, you know, we only work with people on the left. We only work with people who are this or that, progressives or whatever. What the fuck? Doesn't the most hardcore conservative, white supremacist, gun-toting, insurrectionist deserve a chance at understanding the possibility of inner peace that, or the Buddha mind? So maybe that's another reason they try to maintain an apolitical stance, is because they want all to feel welcome.
And I wonder sometimes, even though some of the greatest activists or most effective activists, I suppose that amounts to the same thing the world's ever known, have taken their sort of solace and drawn their power from spirituality, Gandhi, Mandela, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, like that, there are also like people that primarily appear to be mystics, I suppose. And if you are a mystic, maybe your primary function is to say that this plane of reality that you are living within is obviously and observably but a fragment of all potential realities. And if you confine yourself to just the organization of the resources on this tiny finite bandwidth, you're sort of wasting your time by doing that.
Yes, listen, at some point, when will you stop differentiating yourself from the mystics? It's just uncomfortable, right? You can't say it out loud. It's funny, you know, it's funny. Like, at some point, you're going to have to be like, you, whatever the way. You know, actually, I don't know how many mystics would even say they were mystics. In fact, most of them don't. So I'm sorry, that's kind of rude to even try to pull you out of the mystic
closet. What about
you,
though, the mystics? And
me? Me? I think that the moment we get caught up in that, you know, then the next thing you know, you want to wear a mystic. I want to be a mystic. I want to be a mystic. I want to walk through walls. I want to teleport. I want to read minds. I want to heal, all that stuff. But all my teachers generally, they try to veer me away from that condition. It's a condition. So, and I just did that to you. I am sorry. Please do not excoriate me. I'm in it with pure love for you. You have a heart out, so that's why I'm stammering.
Don't worry about that. Someone will come and get me, I'm sure. Duncan, like I could offer the same thing to you, that I feel that you are so erudite and so bright and so worldly and so able to bring together complicated ideas and convey them amusingly and use personal experience to illustrate points that you've obviously been on a journey and have used personal tragedy to escalate your own spiritual advancement. And like with me, the reason that I like, you know, I err on the side of modesty is because like I know what it's like in here. I know what it's like in here, Duncan. You know, sometimes I'm like a child, and not in a good way, not in the way that Christ suggests that we be like children. Not just I'm innocent and nothing but play. I am wrapped in angst and sinew and knotted in body and wanting and just so lost in it, and so lachrymose and hopeless. And like they said, oh man, I did a talk at a very famous British public school called Eton, because a dear friend of mine's child is at this public school, Eton, and I love him. And so I did it for him. And also, as we, you know, let's all love one another. We've all been born where we've been born. We're all at the school that we're at. But there are many narratives about, you know, Eton has produced from the, you know, the Duke of Wellington to George Orwell to, I think, perhaps the majority of British prime ministers. So when I was there at this school with the, you know, peculiarly dressed but somewhat delightfully dressed young men, it's a boys' school, that were there, and I was doing a talk, like, there was a bit where I said, Duncan, like, even though this is a world that I don't entirely recognize, it's not my background, What I do recognize is young men, adolescents. This is when I received the wound, I said in a long grooming talk, Duncan, where I also dropped names like Michel Foucault, terms like anarchist calisthenics, the necessity for regular rule breaking every single day, constant distrust of the establishment and a willingness to engage in revolution. In the midst of it, I talked about, like, you know, like what I recognize in you, you are young men, so you must know the wound. You must know the wound that I know, and I remember it. I remember it like I was just then. Like, in, you know what it's like as a comedian or a public speaker? You sort of, like, if you're actually not if you're not leading with humor and you're not using material, and that's, you know, I was being occasionally funny, I hope, but like also I was sort of giving a public talk, yeah. You know. It's harder to read the room. God, one of the things that's so reassuring about comedy is they laugh. They laugh, so you know that they're right. There and you know that they're listening. Right. And on some level, you hope that they love you. It's very difficult to laugh at someone that you hate, at least collectively and joyously. And then, anyway, sort of somewhere in the midst of this great torrent of words that I issued, I'd said this thing that one of my teachers said to me: from the wound comes the salve. That, you know, that, and this is a sort of a common trope in recovery, that your injury and your past will become a gift to you in so much as pragmatically you'll help other people, you know, right. In a very obvious way, but also you'll recognize who you are and who you're not and the necessity of your journey, and perhaps how you'll begin to see that there is no separateness and there is no otherness, and all relationships are a reflection and refraction of deeper or different aspects of who you are, yeah. And that there's a sort of a beautiful game taking place, that occasionally it brushes past you and you feel it on the deeper senses, and you know it when you feel it. And in the midst of it, I goes, you know, I said this wound is the self thing. And these kids, the questions they asked were so erudite and brilliant. It was strange to hear it coming from their young and piping voices. But indeed, as they say, from the mouths of babes, one of these kids towards the back, about 14, 16, I don't know. They're all kids to me, said something. They said, you mentioned that we're all separated from the totality and that there's inevitability to our wounding. And that the wounding will be addressed through some homeopathic remedy. I said, I didn't say homeopathic remedy. He went, you said that the salvation would come from the wound. I was like, oh my God, that's literally what a homeopathic remedy. Like, oh my God, look at the level this kid is tracking it on. I said, you're so clever. It comes across as patronizing, but all it is that you're clever. And wow. It was remarkable even to know that they were listening to such a degree. It was encouraging that they were interested in the way that they appeared to be. But also, God, man, Duncan, and I think you'll identify with this, is like I wasn't there with like someone that I know well enough to sort of go, that was amazing. You're a genius. I love you. Well done. You're fantastic. Like afterwards. So I had no debrief. So I just sort of left there like, oh my God, was that good? Was that good? What happened there? I sort of I drove into a concrete bollard a little later, which I informed the council of and had repaired, of course, as a responsible citizen. But like, I was sort of like, I didn't get to land. I didn't get to ground again, Duncan. Oh, man.
Yeah.
I had to forge friendships for reassurance.
It's like getting bad ecstasy, you know, like you're expecting some wonderful come up and then nothing. You don't get that feeling that you get from being a performer. You don't get to drive away feeling this temporary sense of like, maybe I am God, you know. So it's hard to do those kinds of things. It's really difficult. I understand. Yeah, I don't like it. That is a terrible feeling. I'm very addicted to the feeling of someone being like, that was great. Without that, it's like, what am I? I need you to tell me I'm great. Oh, I love that tattoo. Look at that. Well, Hare Bo, Hare Krishna. Russell, I could talk to you forever. Thank you so much for giving me your time. I know you're tremendously busy. And as always, this was great, and you are amazing, and thank you so much for coming on the show. I have always learned so much from hanging out with you.
Learn a lot from you, and I've learned a lot about Naked and Afraid today, for example.
God damn it! It's good. You got to watch it.
I will watch it. Can I read you? Like last time we spoke, although it was on my podcast, you read a poem. Can I read a poem to you that I just read the other day that seems appropriate because it's like, you know, like they discovered or they did, they were able to digitally image the Titanic recently, you know? And we were able to see it. And Thomas Hardy, the is he English? Is he Welsh? He's certainly English speaking, but I don't want to offend Welsh people if indeed he's Welsh. Poet wrote this beautiful verse, lines on the loss of Titanic. I guess he's contemporaneous. I guess he's written this when it happened, Duncan. And it's called The Convergence of the Twain. And after that, can I do some promo for my stand-up thing? Unless you can,
of course,
unless you can fold it into your stuff.
I'll do both.
All right, man. Well, so this is called The Convergence of the Twain by Thomas Hardy, Lines on the Loss of the Titanic. In a solitude of the sea, deep from human vanity and the pride of life that planned her, stilly couches she. Steel chambers late the pyres of her salamandrine fires. Cold currents thrid and turn to rhythmic tidal lyres. Over the mirrors meant to glass the opulent, the sea worm crawls, grotesque, slimed, dumb, indifferent. Jewels in joy designed to ravish the sensuous mind, lie lightless, all their sparkles bleared and black and blind. Dim, moon-eyed fishes near gaze at the gilded gear and query, what does this vaingloriousness down here? Well, while was fashioning this creature of cleaving wing, the imminent will that stirs and urges everything prepared a sinister mate for her, so gaily great, a shape of ice for the time far and disassociate. And as the smart ship grew in stature, grace and hue, in shadowy silent distance grew the iceberg too. Alien they seemed to be, no mortal eye could see the intimate welding of their later history, or sign that they were bent by paths coincident on being anon twin halves of one august event, till the spinner of the years said, now, and each one hears, and consummation comes, and jars two hemispheres.
Wow. It's just the death tarot card. No, it's good. The death tarot card. It means change. It just means change.
It's just an iceberg.
Enjoy the Titanic.
It's just an iceberg tearing through the hull. It's just all human endeavor laying at the bottom of the sea, swum over in total darkness by creatures millions of years behind you on the evolutionary scale. Oh, man.
Amazing.
Yes. May I say about my stuff, Duncan,
please?
When I put down Thomas Hardy, I can't even read. My comedy special, Brandemic, will be premiering on July the 11th on Moment. This is more than a comedy show, Duncan. It's a call for freedom, a call for unity. It's my comedy show. I don't need to read that bit, do I? I can ignore that. That's my artistic freedom if I say that. Go to moment.co./Russell Brand from the 1st of June to pre-order your tickets. It's good. It's funny. And also I do that festival. And by God, why aren't you coming there? Will you come there? Between July the 14th and July the 17th, there's a 3-day festival. Hey on Why, Vandana Shiva, Wim Hof, Bruce Parry, B.S. Simkin, wow. Satish Kumar, Kiran Gracie, yoga, breathwork, radical theories and ideas. And Duncan Trussell, if he was, we'd pay your flight if you wanted to come. You, your family.
Oh my God, I would accept it. Thank you. But my wife, she's about to give birth. That's right in the zone right there. So we can't travel. But God, how kind of you. If you keep doing that, I would love to come to the next one. If you do another one, I would love to come to that. That's incredible. What a lineup, man.
Be good, I think.
Yeah, that's everybody. That's insane. Wow. Yo, everybody, you heard it. All the links you need to find the festival and to watch Russell's no doubt awesome special will be at DuncanTrussell.com if you can't remember them. And Russell, bless you. Hare Krishna. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Duncan. Thank you. Thank you.
That was Russell Brand. Everybody, all the links you need to find the events he mentioned are going to be at duncantrussell.com. A tremendous thank you to our sponsors. Thank you for listening. Won't you come see me in Phoenix? Come see me in Florida. I love you. Have a wonderful week, weekend, and lifetime. I'll see you next week. Hare Krishna.